This is Fair Mormon Frameworks on the Mormon Faircast. The Fair Mormon Frameworks series seeks to present Latter-day Saints whose grasp or knowledge about a specific topic can help us consider different frameworks within the gospel that lead with faith. I am your host, Bill Real. Mark Ashurst McGee, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good. I have been leading up to this interview for some time. You work for the Church History Department, correct?
That's correct.
With a major focus on the Joseph Smith Papers Project, right?
Yes, there are several divisions in the department, and I'm in the Publications Division, which includes the Joseph Smith Papers Project.
Awesome. Mark, for those who are not aware of who you are, would you mind just for a few minutes just sharing maybe a brief bio of yourself? And that way it'd give listeners something to kind of get a start on.
Sure. I was born and raised in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then I went to Brigham Young University and majored in mathematics and history, minored in philosophy, and then ended up going to Utah State University for a master's degree in history, and finally Arizona State University for a PhD in history. And I've been working on personal and Mormon history projects and working as a research assistant and doing Mormon history since about 1992. I've been with the Joseph Smith Papers Project full-time since 2002, and I'm currently a senior historian here at the Church History Library.
Wonderful. Well, again, we're glad to have you on. It'll give us a chance to ask a few questions about the Joseph Smith Papers Project specifically, and then maybe some other issues generally. But I wanted to start off by asking you, what was it early on that got you really excited about history, that this was the path you went down?
Well, that goes back to high school, and I was converted to mathematics. I trusted mathematics, but I was kind of an angsty teenager and filled with doubts and didn't trust any other subject that I studied in school. And there was one other thing I trusted aside from mathematics, and that was the scriptures, the LDS scriptures. And it was the historical headnotes to the Revelations and the Doctrine and Covenants that started getting me interested in church history. And, you know, seeing references HC to the history of the church, and then going to look some things up there and looking up some other things in the Mormon History Library that my parents had. That's where I started my interest in church history.
That's incredible. That's great. You know, history is one of those fantastic subjects that I loved as well growing up. And I joined the church when I was 17, and when I did so, I just grabbed every book I could on Mormonism and read everything. And obviously, when we do that, you know, there's this general storyline or simplified story that we tell in church, and there's a reason for that. And I think I've covered that before in multiple episodes, so I don't think my listeners will have any kind of conflict with hearing that spoken about. But what I want to talk about is, in regards to the history department, it feels like in the past that the church was not anxious to open up any difficult history to the average member of the church, that they would prefer that members, you know, deal with the positive stuff that edifies and uplifts. And I think there's value to that. But it seems like in the last couple of years that there's been a slight shift in that. And I think the Joseph Smith Papers Project certainly speaks to this and being a lot more open with the history. What do you account for that general change of direction?
Well, I think the deep roots of that actually are the growth of the church and the professionalization of the field of history first, and then the church history department workforce. And in the early days of the historian's office, you know, it was a smaller church. This was headquarters, and it was kind of a amateur, or I shouldn't say amateur, but it was the people who were working in the historian's office were not trained as historians. And so, you know, of course, in the in the 20th century, the field of history professionalized in early and middle 20th century, and the church grew dynamically in the middle and late 20th century, and the church history department started hiring people with academic training in history, and I think things slowly just began to professionalize. And there came to a point where the church needed to have the church history department needed to have a standardized, regular, reasonable, defensible access policy. And of course, the church owns a tremendous amount of records which cannot be made public. That's just very plain because, of course, disciplinary council records cannot be made public. That's not appropriate. It's not ethical. Financial records, again, need to be kept confidential and private, and those are, there are both ethical and legal considerations there. And then, of course, in the Mormon religion, there are aspects of the Mormon temples which are considered sacred and private and not to be shared outside of the temple. And so there are many things that the church wants to and needs to keep restricted as a private corporation and as a church with sacred temple religion and financial records and church discipline and all those things. So, but all those things are different from the categories of just things that are just sensitive or things that make the church look bad or members of the church look bad or uncomfortable things in history. That's a separate category. And it used to be that the church was, guarding its image. And this is, again, natural from how the church was embattled with the government and with American culture in the 19th century and going into the 20th. So it was natural to feel guarded about sources that were sensitive or uncomfortable, even if they didn't have anything in them that was sacred or private or confidential. And so it was really important when it came to a point where the staff of the archives in the library got together and hammered out a standard, regular, sensible, reasonable, defensible access and restriction policy to where there are certain records in the church which are classified as sacred, private, or confidential that have restrictions on them, and everything else is open to the public.
Awesome. It does very much. And you pointed out a couple of things, right? Because the critics like to come along and say that we're hiding a bunch of stuff in the First Presidency vault. But on some level, there are things that are stored away that nobody's ever going to see that rightfully should be stored away that nobody should ever see. And so sometimes this claim that there's things that we're hiding is really a criticism that's unfair because nobody wants these disciplinary council records to be known to the public. They shouldn't be. They're confidential things. And so, the way you're explaining it helps us understand that some of the criticisms that are made by those outside our faith, that some of them really aren't really fair ground to stand on. And you also point out too the idea behind us having had historians in the past who were church leaders first and then called to serve as historians. And we should expect a whole different approach with those brethren than with somebody who has academically done history their entire life.
Yeah, that's just natural. And I think we've reached a point where the church history department is a department of the church. It's under church supervision, and ultimately under the supervision of it's under the supervision of the church historian, who is a general authority, and has advice from the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. And so, what we have now is we have a workforce of professionally trained historians and people from other related training that fits the needs of the department, integrated with the church structure, with the corporation of the president of the church, and with the church historian and the Quorum of 70 and the 12 apostles and the first presidency. And so what we have reached now is, I think, a very healthy integration of the academically trained professional workforce with the ecclesiastical supervision.
Right. And we talked about on this podcast a couple weeks ago, you won't be aware of this, but we talked about on this podcast a couple weeks ago why some leaders in the past chose to be a little more protective of the faith, and how our church was a church that was persecuted heavily for years and years, you know, generations, and how that mentality sometimes causes us to put up a wall at times to exposing ourselves to damaging things. And so some of those things you're speaking of, I think certainly at home, and I hope people listening recognize, you know, why the church did things the way they did and why they're doing things the way they are now. In relation to the Joseph Smith Papers Project, how's it decided, you know, what's included and what's left out? How do you guys figure all that out?
Oh, that's a really good question. Of course, the Platonic ideal in documentary editing is comprehension, to have a comprehensive edition that publishes absolutely everything, right? Then the other side of the balance sheet there is the financial realities, the funding and the institutional support, workspace, all of those kinds of issues. You have to balance out what you want to do with what you're able to do. And traditionally, you know, there's really haven't been any major documentary editions that have been able to be entirely comprehensive. And the fact of the matter is, there's a sense in which you really wouldn't want to be absolutely comprehensive in terms of publishing on paper all of the different versions of a certain document. For example, we have Revelations that exist in many different versions, but it's essentially the same text over and over again. This is also the case with regard to what's called, normally in the field, we call routine documents, and these are documents that are of a very routine nature and kind of the same thing over and over again. So, for example, Kirtland banknotes or elder's licenses that were signed by Joseph Smith, and it's just the same form, printed form, that's signed over and over and over and over again, and you don't want to print every single one of those in paper, right? However, there's traditionally what projects have done is they've tried to do a comprehensive edition in microfilm or online, and then do a very selective edition in print. And ultimately, that's kind of the same traditional path that the Joseph Smith Papers Project will follow. So online at our website, which is www.josephsmithpapers.org, we will attempt to post up every document that we can gain access to. And we have the full cooperation of the church. However, there are Joseph Smith documents that are in private possession among the Mormon history collecting community that we don't necessarily have or have access to or have permission to publish or text or images of. So that's a long answer to a short question. The main idea is that the website will try to include absolutely everything, and the print volumes will still be fairly comprehensive, but they'll have to be somewhat selective in terms of the amount of those that we can afford to produce and in terms of handling different versions of documents and making selections among routine documents.
Excellent. I want to ask kind of a two-part question here. You had mentioned some of the leaders that you work with, the church historian, assistant church historian, and those above them. And so recognizing that Brother Snow is the church historian and Brother Richard Turley is the assistant church historian, I believe. And both of those men have, and both those men have offices in the same building that you work in, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Do you see much of them?
You see them around, yeah.
Okay. The question I want to ask is, and maybe this will be a difficult one because I'm not asking you to put words in their mouth at all, but recognizing that we have general church members who are called to the position of church historian. So, for instance, Brother Snow may, in his own private time growing up, maybe he liked history, but that wasn't a calling that came because he was a historian. That was a calling that came as a spiritual calling within the church. And I recognize that Brother Turley is, in many ways, a historian. So maybe this doesn't apply to him. But do we know if people like Elder Snow and others who have served as church historian, Brother Jensen, Marlon Jensen before him, if they're aware of the difficult issues, and not only if they're aware of them, but if they're aware of why they bother and trouble some members? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I can tell you that they're very aware of those issues. They travel in their other church assignments, and they attend various conferences and meetings and events where all of these things come up. I was just in Council Bluffs, Iowa, at the annual meeting of the John Whitmer Historical Association, and both Elder Snow and Rick, the church historian and assistant church historian, were both there. And we were, sitting together through these different sessions of the history conference where all manner of controversial historical episodes and aspects of church history came up. So they're very aware of those. And as you may know, Elder Jensen somewhat addressed, is on the record to some extent addressing these concerns and expressing concern about members who are struggling with issues of faith and history. Elder Snow is the same way.
Good. And that's good. And I think members that are struggling want to hear that. They want to know that leaders are aware of why these things bother them or trouble them as they try to work through the context of them and try to figure out how to make heads and tails and find a way to lead with faith, that the leaders are also aware of it. And perhaps that means that some other thoughts and help is coming down the pipe, which I think we're already seeing from Elder Uchtdorf's recent conference talk, Elder Holland's talk from the past conference. But the follow-up question to that then, with having those two in the building and having them aware of the issues, as you're working on the Joseph Smith Papers project, and as that project has openly covered things such as Joseph using seer stones and discussion of polygamy and polyandry and those types of aspects of church history, how have you guys, you meaning Mark Ashurst McGee and the rest of the group working on this project, how do you guys work alongside with these two leaders? How does that organization work in putting this project together? I mean, every time you guys discover something, do you guys have to run things by them, or are they putting in constant input on how to include something or how something should be shaped?
No, their main interaction, I think, with the project has been, overseeing budgets and schedules. Other than that, they're not really involved in the nitty-gritty of the history. I mean, that's what the staff is for. But when a volume has been put together and has run through the internal review of the project itself, then the volumes do get run up the line to both Edler Snow and Brother Rick Turley.
Are they reading the whole book?
For their review. If they had enough time, I'm sure they'd love to read the whole book. I'm sure I'd guess that Rick probably has read all the way through most or all of the volumes, but they don't necessarily read all the way through.
Gotcha. It sounds like you guys have a lot of freedom to oversee the project yourselves and to include what needs included and to leave out what doesn't really add to the comprehensive history of the church.
Yes, that was a concern to me when I first hired on to the project, but I feel very comfortable with how things have gone. I don't feel like the project has lost its scholarly freedom. Now, this is a church-funded project. It is being worked on by employees of the church under the supervision of church leaders, ultimately. So there's no guarantees of what could happen. Anything is possible, I suppose, in the future. But I've been with the project for over a decade now, and I feel great about the scholarly integrity of the project.
Awesome. When I was at the church history department on my trip to Utah for the Fair Conference, had a wonderful chance to walk through a lot of the areas of your building and got an idea of some of the projects and things that people were working on. I know that the critics point to the Council of 50 Minutes as a document that they have long waited to get their hands on and have supposed what is in there. And obviously we probably need to wait till the Joseph Smith Papers volume comes out. But what has been your impression of working with that document?
It's a tremendous document. There's great information in it. And, you know, like you say, because it hasn't been available, people have made guesses and predictions about its contents and what is and is not in there. And as you might imagine, I think it's just going to be, it will, live up to some things more than people expected. Won't live up to other expectations. And, there are the sensational aspects of the Council of 50, in some history and in journalism, but anti-Mormonism. But the historical value of the minutes will be readily apparent to serious historians who care about, Nauvoo and the founding era.
Right. You've talked about each volume having some document that had been with the first presidency and not really available until that volume came out. And it seems like with this volume, with the Council of 50 Minutes, you've really, really topped that with something that everybody's looking forward to. Does that kind of set a high bar for volumes coming in the future?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we're just publishing Joseph Smith's papers, whatever they are, is what we publish. And not everything is as interesting to some people as it is to others. We have, loads of documents that many people would consider boring, and, they are what they are, and different people will appreciate different kinds of documents, and it's really kind of a straightforward papers project in that respect. We don't feel beholden to any bar for producing sensational products.
Okay, so the next volume is not like, hey, we have to go into the First Presidency vault and find some other thing to put in the next one. Okay, I know the books have sold well at Deseret Book and other places, and I assume that'll continue. Is there a set plan for how many volumes come after the current one you're working on?
Not exactly. We're shooting for about 24 volumes. Not everything is set in stone exactly, but something around there.
Excellent. That'll be quite a resource. I mean, that's going to be quite comprehensive. It'll be difficult for any one person to be an expert on all of those, but it sounds like you're putting together a wealth of information that will change the dynamics, I think, for generations to come.
I think it will too, and we've already started to see the beginning of that with the new section headings for the 2013 edition of the Doctrine and Covenants.
Mark, the other question I wanted to ask you was, I know in the past that the way in which materials come forward in the church and the things that we get during the 3-hour block on Sundays, that the history department has been kind of a separate entity from that. And that I know that in the last few years, and hopefully going forward, that the history department has a little more influence on the things that we get to talk about and discuss during the 3-hour block on our Sundays during church. And wondered if you could maybe share if you've had a chance to have within your department or you personally any influence in what the church does in regards to the 3-hour block on Sundays.
Well, I can kind of tell you the general direction of the trajectory that I think things are on. And again, I don't speak for the Elder Snow or the department, but looking back at it historically for a long time, just up until the last few years, the church history department was essentially a combination of the church archives, the church library, and the church museum. And the department supported those three institutions. And so it was really kind of a repository institution. But the real purpose of the church history department is bigger than that. In addition to collecting and preserving history and sharing it with people who walk into the archives of the library or the museum, it needs to be shared in a greater sense. In other words, the church history department needs to be doing history. It's not the church library department or the church archives department. It's the church history department. And so in the just over the last few years, the department has been reorganized to reflect that vision of the mission of the department. And so now we have the Joseph Smith Papers Project going. We have the Revelations in Context going on the website and several other different things going on the website. And so the department is moving into producing, not only keeping records, but producing history. And as that happens, it's only reasonable that this needs to be, at least to some extent, synchronized with the other church materials that bear on church history in whatever curricula. So I'd say the general direction is that the department will be in better communication with the other departments of the church, and that influence will continue to influence regular church curriculum.
Mark, another question I had for you. You talked about this church website, and I believe you're talking about the history.lds.org. Is this the Revelations in Perspective?
Revelations in Context is one of the offerings on the church history website.
Right, and that caught people's eyes a few months ago. There was an article on there about Oliver Cowdery and him working the divining rod, which Joseph and others perhaps called the Rod of Aaron. I just wanted to ask, does your department, you make it sound like you guys have a big influence on this website as well. Is that the case?
Yeah, several of those treatments in the Revelations in Context series were done by editors of the Joseph Smith Papers Project who had recently worked on those revelations for the document series.
Awesome. And I want to just make a mention to my listeners. If you are not aware of this little side site on the church's website, you ought to check it out. There is really a bunch of stuff there, including a lot of information on the Joseph Smith papers, but it is at history.lds.org. And there are several different sections that you can kind of click into. The one that Brother Ashurst McGee is speaking of is the Revelations in Context section, but there's just a wealth of information here, and if you're struggling to find the context of some revelation in the church or some document or information, this would be a wonderful place to start. I assume we can expect this site to get a whole lot bigger over the upcoming years, correct?
Yes, there's now a handful of full-time employees that are working on the website, and it will continue to grow, yes.
The Joseph Smith paper volumes, they're certainly affordable. They're not terribly expensive. I've been on to the point here. The next time I get in contact with some of these books without having to pay for shipping, next time I'm in a church bookstore or something, I'm going to pick some of these up. But Is there a way that at some point these will be online available to like the general public without having to purchase them? Or is this going to always probably be a book that you're going to buy?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer is that eventually everything will be online. And that's important to the church, that members don't have to pay to be able to have this information. So it will all be made available online in time.
Awesome. Is there an index? Assuming this all takes place, right, there'll be an index somewhere where somebody can go and look at it. I guess what I'm getting at, there's a lot of things that the church has in its possession, church, you know, historical documents. Do you guys have an index that you work off of? Is there a way that, you know, you guys as researchers, as people in the department looking for different documents, is there a master list of everything the church has so that you can kind of figure out where to start your search?
Yes, it's called the Church History Library Catalog, and it's like any other major library catalog, and it has, you know, several search functions, and we use it all the time. And of course, as you may know, libraries catalog everything at item level, you know, with a book as the model. Archives, where you're collecting and storing hundreds and thousands of pages of different collections that come in, normally don't have item-level description. They'll describe things at series level, and for certain collections you'll have registers or finding aids and guides of various kinds. And we have those as well here, and I know that they've started, and maybe they're finished by this point, of integrating those finding aids, registers, and other finding aids into the catalog, into the online catalog.
Right. And then years in the past, I think it would be fair to say that because, and I don't even know what the First Presidency Vault looks like. I'm imagining this safe like a bank would have, where you, huge thing that you open up and go into. I don't know what the case is, but I know that at some point in the past, the leaders may have been not completely aware of everything that was in there, but I assume we're to a point now where everything that's in there is part of this index. Now, obviously some things probably are accessible and some things are not, but everything is at least indexed, and everybody has kind of a clue in your department or within the church hierarchy of what's in the church's possession and what isn't. Is that a fair question?
Yeah, that's a fair question. The holdings of the First Presidency are separate from the Church History Department. So the Church History Library catalog does not catalog the holdings of the First Presidency. In terms of the Joseph Smith Papers Project, my understanding is that the project has access to everything that's appropriate, everything needed for the Joseph Smith papers, everything that we would need as a Joseph Smith document. My understanding is that they've been able to go through their holdings and provide us with that material.
Great. Good. All right. I want to finish up with just a couple little questions about some things you've done personally. I know you wrote, I believe, your master's thesis on about a 400-page paper regarding the seer stones and the Urim and Thummim. Is that correct? So I don't know if you don't mind me asking a couple of questions that just that I was thinking of as I was printing off a lot of your paper yesterday and trying to at least glance through it. I thought it was amazing. I can't imagine how long it took you to put that together. I don't know if you want to share with us how long that took.
I spent a few years on that. I think, let's see, I guess 3 years on that, of course, not full time, but through my coursework and in my thesis hours. It did take extra time to write one that long.
Right. I think you actually probably worked quite fast, because I'm sitting here looking at the 400 or so pages of that that product and thinking to myself, this would take me a decade to even begin to put together. So hats off to you.
It was a lot of hard work.
Yeah, and I can appreciate that. I hope people will check into it, you can still purchase that paper online. I'll leave the link for that on the listing for this episode. But a couple things I wanted to ask you. There was some discussion about the Urim and Thummim, and I've seen a couple of pictures that show these spectacles that could be folded in half, and that on one lens there was a triangle that faced, you know, up, and then on the other lens a triangle that faced down, and when these folded, that it would make the Star of David. And I, as I'm sitting here thinking about the Urim and Thummim and seer stones and all that goes into the, you know, the early translation of the Book of Mormon, any thoughts from you on what the Urim and Thummim may have looked like? I mean, I've seen a couple of witness statements, but I don't know that they're as descriptive as I'd love to really hear what those things look like.
Yes, well, we do have a few descriptions of the spectacles from Joseph Smith and others. Joseph Smith, of course, claimed to have seen them. The three witnesses claim to have seen them in their vision of the golden plates in their witness experience. And Lucy Mack Smith claims to have handled them under some fabric. And it's from Lucy Mack Smith that you get the description of the lenses as three-cornered diamonds, as she puts it. So there's apparently three-cornered or triangular-shaped diamond or some other transparent rock encased within these crystalline lenses of the spectacles. That she's the only one who describes them in that way. She doesn't say how the triangles are situated. She doesn't talk about the lenses folding in half. Nobody does. Nobody talks about the lenses folding in half. It's possible that if you were to look through the lenses, the way the triangles are would make a Star of David, but that's just speculation.
Right, right. Well, I appreciate that. And I realize I'm drawing on something that you wrote many years ago, and so I'm not expecting you to pull every single detail right off the top of your head. There's no way to probably even remember 400 pages worth of information. But the other thing I was thinking about too, we speak a little bit about Joseph's treasure hunting experience when he's younger, and Brant Gardner has talked a little bit about Joseph being more of a lost item finder who did some treasure hunting upon request when Josiah Stoll sought him out. And this is something I spoke of on an episode or two ago on my podcast, where we have some information from Joseph being essentially the neighborhood guy you go to if you lost something, and he would, through his seer stone, help you find it. And then we have Josiah Stoll from a long distance away coming to seek out Joseph's services. Would it be, from your understanding, would it be a fair narrative to see Joseph as just this local lost item finder who happens to do treasure digging once or twice but is really not a treasure digger? Is that a fair paradigm to put Joseph into?
I think that's... I do. I think that's fair enough. Although we know that he dug for treasure more than once or twice, but how many times did he dig for treasure is uncertain. Dan Vogel did an article in Dialogue in 1994 where he tried to enumerate all the different specific digs that are attributed to Joseph Smith, and he comes up with a list of about 20 different digs over the course of 7 or 8 years. Which, you know, how much digging is that really? You know, it's averaging a dig or two every year. I think that's probably more concentrated in some years. And I also think that some of those digs that Vogel compiles are probably not true. In terms of this point about Joseph Smith being primarily, or of having a wider role of a seer than being a treasure seer, and of being primarily someone who finds lost things, that's a point I also made in my thesis. And I was drawing on Richard Anderson there, and I believe he's the first person to make this point. And he's using later published notes that were taken during the 1826 court proceeding. And in the section where Joseph Smith's testimony is reported, Joseph himself is reported as having saying that he helped people find things that were lost, and that on occasion he searched for treasure. And so I don't know how accurate those notes are in representing what he said, but that really is one of our very best sources on Joseph Smith's role as a seer and as a treasure seer, because it apparently is contemporaneous. Whereas most of the things about Joseph and treasure seeking come after the Golden Plates and the Book of Mormon, and often years and even decades and even a half a century after the fact. And this is after Joseph Smith has made a splash in the religious scene, and a controversial one, and people looking back on him are especially interested in this treasure-seeking angle. And use it deliberately, and it's easy to see that they use it deliberately to discredit him. And this is more sensational than his role as someone who helps people find things that are lost, which we can also document. There's less documentation there, and I don't think that is representative of the reality of the contemporaneous reality. I think it's more representative of the sensationalism of treasure seeking and how that's used in later years to discredit him.
Yeah. Yep. That's good. That is good. And one thing I want to follow it up with really quick is, do we know, I mean, Josiah Stoll is somewhere near Harmony, Pennsylvania. Joseph is in Palmyra, New York. And yet Josiah somehow catches wind. I don't get the feeling like Joseph's putting ads in the newspaper, right? I mean, he's not saying, you know, treasure digger for hire.
Yes. Well, Stoll, when he approaches Joseph Smith or hears about him, he's been at Simpson Stoll, which I believe is his brother, who does live up in Joseph Smith's neck of the woods.
Gotcha. So he's catching wind of Joseph's reputation, and on some level, right, Joseph has to be somewhat successful on some level with this ability to help people find things. And I think Brant Gardner or somebody else has recorded that at least one or two instances of Joseph having been successful in locating something.
Smiths don't just work on their farm. They hire out as day laborers, and they hired out as well diggers, as we know, and that was apparently connected with Joseph Smith Sr.'s water witching, possibly
right.
Some with Joseph Smith Jr. So they do, they're not just there on their farm. They do travel somewhat in the local area as laborers, and possibly in connection with their gifts.
Right. And that's it. I'm trying to word this carefully because I'm not trying to come off as making this sound more witchcrafty than what it is. I think there are things that are going on that in today's perspective we no longer see as okay, and we don't understand for sure. And when we say Joseph Smith and his sons were hired out as digging wells, in our present understanding, we simply want to say that these guys were good at digging a hole, but in reality, in their day, they had to be great at finding water. And so there's some level of them having an ability that is recognized by the community as being a real ability to locate things that the average person can't do.
Yeah, the sources that we have do point in that direction. Of course, there's no great documentation on the 1820s. It just doesn't exist. Almost everything is retrospective, but putting all the sources together and looking at them, they do point in that direction. And, of course, that was very, very common in early America to douse your wells before you dug them. And in fact, it's still common in America.
Yeah, when I talk about it on my podcast, I'll get an email or two whenever I mention it in one of my episodes from somebody who says they either have their dad or uncle or somebody they know who still does that today and swears that it works.
Well, I've had plumbers out of my house that have pulled out their copper rods to find a line.
Okay. So there we go. I want to finish off just asking briefly about seer stones. Do we know if we have in the church's possession any of the original seer stones that Joseph used?
There's every indication of that. That's best treated in D. Michael Quinn's book on early Mormonism and the magic worldview. He produces several sources from earlier in the church's history indicating that the church has at least a couple of Joseph Smith seer stones.
But in your work with the Joseph Smith papers, it's not something that you guys have asked for to take a picture of or to see or to look at or to inspect. Okay. And then I want to end on a humorous note. When I joined the church, and I read No Man Knows My History by Fawn Brody before joining, so I was aware of Joseph and treasure digging and seer stones and all that before I even got baptized. And at an early age, one of the things I tried to do was I would go find neat looking rocks outside and try to, you know, put them in my hand and block out the light and see if I could see anything. Being a history nut and being aware of that stuff, is that something you've ever tried to do?
No, I don't really. I believe that Joseph Smith had this ability, and I believe that God can speak to man in that way if he so chooses. I myself have never really felt anything like that. You know, it's been a great, obviously it's been of great interest to me historically, but I guess I don't feel like it's a spiritual gift of my own.
I gotcha. So officially for my listeners, I'm the nutcase and you're the one who's saying, cause I've tried that several times when I was younger I'd be walking outside and I would just see some neat little rock among other rocks that was different and try to be silly for just 10 seconds and say, okay, maybe this one works.
That's the anthropological method of participant observation. You can, instead of being a nutcase, you can be the anthropologist and I'll just be the historian.
Awesome. If people want to know more about you or the Joseph Smith papers, we've already shared the historical website on the church's, the link from the church's site. Any other things that you'd recommend people go look up or go look into and to try to find out more?
No, I would just highly recommend looking at the website. It is free and, there's already a tremendous amount of great material there.
And besides Deseret Book, is there any other places that are carrying the Joseph Smith papers volumes?
Oh yeah, it's been distributed much more widely than just Deseret Book.
Okay, so Amazon and other places, people can probably get their hands on those.
Or any of the major online book dealers.
Excellent. Mark Ashurst McGee, thank you so much for being on the program today.
It's been fun, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Mormon Faircast. If there is an issue that you've been wondering about, you can often find the latest answers at the Fair Mormon Wiki, found at fairmormon.org. If you can't find your answer there, feel free to pose your question to the Fair Mormon Apologist by visiting the Fair Mormon contact page. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help us increase the popularity of this podcast by subscribing in iTunes and by writing a review. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Chris Rice. The opinions expressed in the podcast are not necessarily the views of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or a Fair Mormon.
Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet, sung by flaming tongues above. Praise the mount, I'm fixed upon it, mount of thy redeeming love. Here I raise my Ebenezer, here by thy great help I've come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Jesus sought me when a stranger, wandering from the fold of God, he to rescue me from danger interposed his precious blood. Precious blood. Oh, that day when freed from sinning, I shall see thy lovely face. Clothed then in blood-washed linen, how I'll sing thy sovereign grace. Come, my Lord, no longer tarry, take my ransomed soul away. Send thine angels now to carry me to realms of endless day. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I am constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above.